How are you tonight? Doing well? I'm glad to hear that. Tonight I want to talk to you about the most fundamental, the most influential, the most vital law of human nature. Now, we noted in a previous presentation that all of creation is governed by laws. Isn't that right? There are physical laws. There are sociological laws. There are psychological laws, emotional laws. There are laws that govern everything in nature, laws of physics. We see laws operating in every aspect of the ecosystem that surrounds us. There are laws of mathematics. The most basic law in the physical realm that we're familiar with is the law of gravity, for example. What goes up? What's the rest of the law? Must come down. Well, all of the laws of nature and the laws of our physical being, as well as our psychological being, all have a common pattern that they move in. They all move, every one of these laws, in a pattern of reciprocation. You remember Ezekiel chapter 1's wheel within a wheel? Rotation within rotation, describing God's glory in all of creation. Everything that God has made operates on the pattern of the movement of His character, which is a circular movement. All of creation is governed by this law, and you see this law, this basic common denominator of all law, you see it everywhere you turn, in and out, up and down, right? All these laws move in perpetual circular motion. And perpetual motion is the law of life. Anything that stops moving dies. And that's how God created this universe in which we live. Now, I want to talk to you tonight very specifically about the most fundamental law of our psychological, spiritual, emotional, human nature. Now, in order to draw our attention there, I want to give you a few examples of how this law operates. When we say of the law of gravity, for example, what goes up must come down, the law we're going to talk about tonight could be spoken of as what goes in must come out. Now, this is true biologically. You all know, don't you, that when you take in calories, when you take food into your body, that there needs to be an equal energy expenditure, or what happens? Well, you get ginormous, in fact, which is like gigantic, but giganticer, and it's like enormous, but enormouser. You get enormouser and enormouser until you become ginormous. If you take in more calories than you put out in energy. So there's the reciprocal law. In, then what? Out. There's the basic weight loss plan. Only eat the calories that you intend to expend. So motion needs to equal the kind of energy that you've put into your body. Now, what about psychologically and emotionally? What goes in psychologically and emotionally also must come out. I mean, look at the world in which we live, and you will see that truly what goes into people's minds finds reflection in the way they behave. Have you noticed that? I like to tell my children how 501s, straight-legged Levi's, came into being back when I was growing up, everybody in the world was wearing bell bottoms. Well, I thought they were ugly. And so I took my bell bottoms and I turned them inside out, and I drew a line with a marker to make them straight legged, and I sewed up that line and cut off the excess, put them on. One kid after another started copying what I was doing. Levi Corporation gave me a phone call, and that's how I made my millions. True story. Actually, you got to be careful about that true story thing. The other night when I told the story about the eagle who thought he was a chicken, somebody came to me afterwards and said, "How do you know that's true?" I said, "It's not." It's not. But watch the patterns in society, and you will see that by beholding, we become changed. For a time, before I was born, you had to wear fat ties. Then ties got skinny. Did you notice that? Now they're about medium, right? I'm very much out of step tonight. I'm wearing a two-button jacket. This is not cool. Right now, three-button jackets are the thing. But I like this suit. And so I wear it sometimes just to remind myself that I don't care what the patterns are in the fashion scene of this world. But we're guided by it, aren't we? And anybody who thinks they're not, one time a girl came to me and she said, "Oh, my parents are so absolutely uncool in the way they dress." And I try to talk to them about it, and they just insist on being uncool in the way they dress. What is wrong with them? Have they no fashion sense, or are they just plain stupid? And I said to her, I said, "No, that is not the case. Your parents actually are in a time warp of cool, so that they don't actually think they look uncool. The fact is, they have an image in their mind back sometime where they defined cool. And they kept that image. And if you don't change the image, you're not going to change the wardrobe." And she said, "Oh." And let her parents off the hook. Well, you see these kids nowadays. I saw a group of them on a campus recently where I was doing meetings. And this one kid had pants that were buckled with a belt around his thighs with a long shirt. And I was so curious. I wanted to know, what is under there? What's under the shirt? I mean, because the waistline of the pants are here. There's got to be something visible under there. And it was just, the curiosity was awful. I had to ask him about it. I said, "What's with the britches, man? They are so low. What's going on?" He said, "Well, just because I don't wear them where you wear them, that doesn't..." I said, "No, well..." He said, I'm myself, man. I'm my own man." And as we continued walking toward the cafeteria, we caught up to some of his friends. I said, "You're your own man, are you?" I said, "How come all of you are doing the same thing?" By beholding, we become changed. Not only does fashion go in patterns, but everything that we see and take in has some degree of effect upon us. Does anyone here remember the movie Gone with the Wind? I don't. But I heard about it. I've never seen it. It was before my mother was born, I think, is when that movie came out. But there was that suave man. Was it Clark Gable? Yeah, Clarky Gable. What a specimen of masculinity, huh? And you know, he did something that had never been done on the silver screen before. You know what he did? He unbuttoned three buttons with no undershirt. And you know what happened? T-shirt sales in the United States plummeted. They dropped. Fruit of the Loom and Hanes got together and said, "Should we merge? One of us has got to go." Because people stopped buying undershirts, because by beholding, they said, "Now that's the new definition of cool here, huh?" And the T-shirts were out the window. Well, you see this all the time in society. I want to ask you a question. It's a bit of a riddle. What is, in fact, here's the riddle. What is, in fact, the most expensive and simultaneously worthless thing in our society? Ties? Is that what someone said? If you buy them in Nordstrom's, you're definitely pouring money down the drain. If you get them at Target, you're doing all right. Not ties. What is the most expensive and simultaneously is not a word, simultaneous worthless thing? It is advertising time for halftime at the Super Bowl. It costs so much money to just have a minute of time during that one spot. Why will they pay multiplied millions of dollars for 60 seconds? Why? Because they know this law, that by beholding, we become changed and purchasing is prompted. I mean, if you were to ask me, Ty, what's your belief system about paper towels? I would say Bounty. Bounty paper towels. They are absolutely the best. If you probed a little deeper and you asked me, Ty, how do you know that Bounty paper towels are the best? I would say, well, I don't really know, but I feel like they're the best. On an emotional level, I have somehow been persuaded through repetitious advertisements that Bounty's the way to go. And I'm about to buy one of those Swiffle things. Have you seen those? Oh, yeah. That's how advertising works. But here's the thing. The moment that kids start doing shooting sprees at school, and a parent says to the media companies, you bear some responsibility for the 18,000 murders that my child witnessed by the time he was 18 via the television. And they said, no way, people aren't influenced by television. And then they pay millions of dollars for a moment at halftime for the Super Bowl. There's a double standard there. They know that people are prompted to act by what they see and by what they hear. So the fact is that this law is always operable in all of our human experiences. Now, we've talked about it at the least consequential level so far tonight. Now I want to talk to you about it where it really matters. For a number of years, probably 5-6 years, I conducted an experiment on teenagers. I would go to do a series of meetings at an academy or a college. Usually at an academy I would do this, and I'd hand out a piece of paper and I'd say, I want to ask you a series of questions and I want you to answer them anonymously, even disguise your handwriting if you'd like, so that you can just be real straight off the cuff honest. I don't want your name, I just want to know what's going on in the corporate head of teenagers in general. So they all got their pencil poised for the questions, persuaded that they needed to be honest. And my first question to the group, I said, cover your answer. It might be embarrassing. You don't want anyone to see, maybe. But answer these questions. Number one, here was the first question. You go ahead and answer it, not out loud, but in your mind. The question was this. If God in heaven is just like your dad, would you want to spend eternity with him? And there's one of two ways you can answer that. Yes or no. Yes, my dad is the kind of guy that if God's like him, I'd love to spend eternity with a God like my dad. Or, are you kidding? No way. If God's like my pops, I do not want to spend eternity with him. So they all answered yes or no. You got two piles so far when I go back to my dorm room and sort them. Second question. Follow carefully now. Second question. If, hypothetically, there is no punishment for being bad and no reward for being good, would you still be a Christian? Everything else is true. God is whoever he is in your thinking. He is who he is. Jesus still came. Everything's true except for all you have is your 70, 80, 90, 100, 110, 150 years. You have 70, 80, 90, 100, 110, 150 years. Right? And it's over. You have that much time, but there's no bad consequences. No punishment, no pain for doing bad stuff, and there's no reward for doing good stuff. Would you still be a Christian? To which they answered either, what? Yes or no, right? Third question. If you could be anything you want to be for a life's profession, with no obstacles in your way, no educational, financial, social obstacles, nothing at all, just bam, you're there, whatever you want to be, what would be your life's profession? Now, when I go back to my room and I sort these papers out, it's very fascinating what emerges. Almost without exception, those who say yes to question one say yes to question two. Are you following it? Yes, if God's like my dad, I'd like to spend eternity with him. And yes, I'd still be a Christian even if I am not punished for being bad and not rewarded for being good. Yeah, I'd still be a Christian. Interesting. And almost without exception, those who say no to question one say no to question two. No. If God's like my dad, heaven, I don't want to go to heaven. I don't want to spend eternity with a God like my dad. Almost invariably, would you still be a Christian if there's no reward for being good, no punishment for being bad? No, of course not. Why would I be a Christian if I'm not going to get anything out of it? If I'm not going to be punished? Now, it's very interesting because the third category that has to do with the practicalities of life and basically what a person chooses to do with their energy, those who answered yes, yes to the first two questions, yes, my dad's cool and I'd love to spend eternity with a God like my dad, and yes, I'd still be a Christian if there's no punishment and no rewards. You know what kind of professions they chose? I want to be a doctor. I want to be a veterinarian. I want to be a pastor. I want to be a missionary. I want to be... What do those kind of professions? I want to be a teacher. I want to be a biologist. What do those professions all have in common? Now, which way are those professions generally reaching? Outward, right? And the kind of professions chosen by the no-no group? Now, there were some exceptions, but this is almost invariable. You know what the list looked like? I want to be a rock star. I want to be an actress. I want to be a sports hero. I want to be, well, forget it. I don't want to be anything. I don't want to work at all. Just give me millions of dollars. I want to be a millionaire. That's what I want to be. I want to be a millionaire. I want to be a model. What do all those kind of professions, and I'm not here to talk about professions, by the way, but what do those professions kind of have in common? Yeah, they're kind of focused on, you know, me, right? Aren't they? I mean, think about it. But there was one exception. There was a third pile. There was a no-yes group. No, I would not want to spend eternity with a God like my dad. But yes, I'd still be a Christian if there's no heaven and no hell. You know what? I probed a little deeper, first to the yes-yes group, and said, really? Why would you be a Christian if there's no rewards or punishments? Do you know what the most profound, simple answer was that they consistently gave? Just kind of off the cuff. Just, well, because I love God. I'm not a Christian because of what I'm going to get out of it at the end or because I'm going to get punished. I love God. You said everything else is the same. God is who He is. So I'd still be a Christian because I want to give whatever I have to God. Even if I only have 80 or 90 or 100 years, I want to give it to God. The no-no group, I said, hey, why not? Why not be a Christian? Well, because I don't see the point. I don't see the point of being a Christian if I don't get to go to heaven. And I certainly don't see the point of being a Christian. I mean, if I'm not going to be punished for being bad, let's party. That was the attitude. But there was an exception, and there was a third pile. It was a small pile. Some people said, no, I wouldn't want to spend eternity with a God like my dad. But yes, I would still be a Christian because I love God. And I probed them a little deeper and I said, well, you're an odd group. Why is it that you're saying yes to the second question? And you know what I discovered? Every kid who has a relationship with daddy that is negative or abusive or hurtful gravitates away from God to one degree or another. And there's a certain kind of kid that gravitates back toward God. That's the little pile. Only those kids who make a clean, distinct break in their perception and say, God's not like my dad, so I love him. those who in Jesus saw a picture of God that was different than what they had received in the home, those were the third small pile that said, no, I wouldn't want to spend eternity with a God like my dad, but God's not like my dad. So, I'd still be a Christian. What an incredible, what a mature spiritual direction for a teenager to be going. It was incredible to me. I experienced it in my own life. The key to this law is that the internal image that we hold somehow sifts out into life, our choices, our behavioral patterns. Here's basically how you and I are wired. This is how life works for you and me. And there aren't any exceptions, okay? Thoughts produce feelings or emotions. We then act primarily out of our emotions. That's the B for behavior. Behavior then, when it is performed in repetition, reinforces what you originally thought. If you are persuaded by someone who is superior in your life, like a parent, for example, or a teacher, or a big bully that follows you to school and back, if you're persuaded to think you're stupid, right, you begin to feel stupid, and then you begin to behave stupid, and then that reinforces, that behavior reinforces your original thought, which in fact was wrong. But here is the most incredible thing. The more you perform and act out through your feelings those behaviors, what was originally untrue becomes truer and truer and truer. And you become intellectually stunted for want of action and expenditure to intellectually pursue a different picture of yourself. I'm not stupid, so I'm not going to feel stupid, so I'm not going to act stupid, and I reject that lie. Right? But we all operate this way, and I've given you just a simple example concerning how a child is raised thinking about themselves. But the reason why we operate this way is because God originally created us to never encounter sin or demeaning thoughts about ourselves. God intended that all of our thoughts would come from His constant affirmation. I love you. You are so cool. I'm your God. I created you. I like you. I want to spend forever with you. Which makes us feel affirmed and beautiful and good in God's eyes. Which makes us behave toward Him in that way, which then reinforces the thoughts that He put there, and it's at this level that maturity takes place. This is where growth occurs. This is where, as those thoughts, I love you, you're valuable, I really care about you, you're important to me, the more you feel those thoughts and act upon them, the more those thoughts are reinforced, and you grow and expand. Intellect expands. Your emotional capacity expands. Your spiritual capacity expands. Even as I'm going to show you, I think, tomorrow at the church service, even biologically, your immune system responds to those positive thoughts and feelings, and actually, you become a more healthy person physically, and longevity is directly attached, scientifically proven, I will show it to you tomorrow, that longevity and good health and a strong immune system is affected by our thoughts and our feelings about ourselves and about other people. It's incredible how God made us. Now, God made us this way, not so that we would get tripped up and have all the problems we have. He never intended for us to ever hear a negative thought about ourselves or about anyone else. So He created us this way so that we could grow. But if you break this cycle, you don't grow. You become, well, the Bible says it somewhat like this: by beholding, you become changed. That's the law of our being. That's what happened to me as a little boy, as I shared with you on the first night of these meetings. I was spiraling downward in every way, educationally, in every way in my life. I couldn't even do my schoolwork. My motivation was torn from me until the day when my mom created a new image in my head. My mom said, "The man in this home that you call daddy who's beating me, he's not your dad. Your dad never hit me." And a new image of my father, my biological father, was created in my head. And I said, "I don't have to be like this guy. I'm going to be like this other person that my mommy has told me about. I'm going to be nice to girls, and I'm not going to hurt them." At 8 years old, that was a very basic, fundamental idea, but it was monumental to chart the course of my life. This law is always in effect without exceptions. And where it gets even more crucial, if you'll take your outline, is in our perception of God. I want you to notice the first scripture here, which we read on a previous night, but now we're going to put it in a context that is directly related to the final wrapping up of Earth's history. We've all heard of the end time and final events. Well, I want to share with you tonight, in the next few moments, really what the crucial issue is at the end time. Follow this reasoning very carefully. John 5:19, Jesus clearly stated the law of beholding in succinct terms before the Apostle Paul ever dealt with the subject. Jesus is the one who first articulated this idea in the New Testament. He said to them, "Most assuredly, I say to you, the Son can," underline that word, "do nothing of himself, but what he," underline that word, "sees the Father do. For whatever he does," that is, whatever the Father does, "the Son does in like manner." Now, the word "do" and "does" is dealing with what part of human experience? The behavioral level, right? Now, when he says, "I do," or "I behave," "I act out what I see of the Father," now he's dealing, when he's talking about what I see, with his thoughts, his perceptions. Jesus has a certain perception of the kind of person God the Father is. Jesus has a theology, you could say, which is theosology, is the study of God. He has a picture of God. Theology means, in so many words, if you don't mind my simplistic paraphrase, theology means picture of God. What is your picture of God? Is to ask, what is your theology? Okay? So, what was Jesus' picture of God? Well, we know what his picture of God was. Why? Because of what he does. On the behavioral level, he says, "Watch how I behave. I do nothing of myself. I only do what I see in the Father. What I believe about God comes out in the way I'm relating to you. I relate to you the way the Father relates. I believe that God is love, so I love you. I believe that God is forgiving, so I forgive you. I believe that God does not condemn you for your failures, so I do not condemn you. I believe that God likes little kids, so I take them in my lap and I bless them," even though the disciples have a different picture of God and say to those mothers, "This is the Messiah. He is setting up his kingdom. Take your kids to some other rabbi. He's important and he's got to do important stuff." And Jesus said, wait a minute. This is the important stuff. Let those little kids come to me and don't forbid them. This is really what it means to set up my kingdom. I'm going to set up my kingdom by loving little kids. I'm going to set up my kingdom by taking them in my arms and blessing them and letting them braid my hair and put flowers in my beard and laughing with them and tickling them. I'm going to set up and extend my kingdom by loving people. That's what Jesus was trying to get through to the disciples. When that one city in Samaria refused to receive him, you remember? John and James came back, ancient biker types that they were, and they said, that city doesn't want you coming here. And they are so mad. And they say to Jesus exactly what they think Jesus will approve of. They say to Jesus exactly what they think is their picture of God and Jesus' picture of God. They won't receive you. Jesus, you speak the word and we will call fire from heaven and we will burn them up. We know you can do miracles. Let's burn them. Let's just burn up the city. And what did Jesus say? He said, no. Let's not burn them up. You do not know what spirit you are of. By which he was saying, it's not my spirit and I don't see that in the Father. Right? So Jesus circumvented and redirected their picture of God. Throughout his life, in every interaction, the disciples were continually baffled. They were like, what? Are we sure this is the Messiah? He's hanging out with kids. Are we sure this is the Messiah? He doesn't want to burn up any cities. Are we sure this is the Messiah? Look at him. He doesn't condemn a lady caught in adultery. Are we sure this is the Messiah? And over again, Jesus was changing their picture of God. And with each additional revolution of their thinking, he would say, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. I do what I see. This is the law, not only of Jesus' experience, but in John 8, 38 through 41 and verse 44, he says the same thing about all human beings. He says, I speak what I have seen with my Father, and you, what's the key word there again? Do, on the behavioral level, you do what you have seen of your Father. You do the deeds of your Father. You behave like your picture of God, in other words. Then they said to him, we have one Father, and that's who? So in all of their actions, who do they think they're emulating? Help me out here. They think they're emulating God. I mean, they literally crucified God in the name of God. They literally pursued a course of murderous intent toward the Messiah, thinking that they were doing what God would do if he were in their shoes. Jesus says, you do the deeds of your Father. They said, we have one Father, and that's God. Jesus said to them, if God were your Father, you would love me. For I proceeded and came forth from God. He's like me. And if your picture of God was right, you would see in me harmony with that picture. But you don't have the right picture in your head. So you think God is someone that in reality he's not. And so then he said in verse 44, you are of your father the devil. You have attributed characteristics of the devil to God. You have transposed attributes that belong to Satan over the character of God. And you think God is like the devil. And you've got it all turned around and upside down. So he says, you will do the desires of your father. You'll do what he wants you to do because we do what we see. Ultimately, we all, at least under pressure, act out our picture of God. And this is why the most crucial issue of your life and mine, the most crucial issue of gospel preaching, the most crucial issue of evangelism, the most crucial issue of preparation for the end time events. Listen, the most vital issue that you will ever grapple with in your entire life is not your retirement. It's not Medicare. It's not where you're going to settle after your working years are done. The absolute most vital issue that you will ever grapple with is the picture you hold in your heart of the character of God. It will determine the content of your head, the shape of your emotions, and the pattern of your behavior. And when all is said and done, there is coming upon this world what we sometimes refer to as a crisis, a test. And in crisis, people ultimately, for sure, act out of their emotions. That's why they're called emotions. The etymology of that word is very, very much just right out on the front of the word, right? What does it mean to have emotions? What does it mean to emote? It means to what? Move. Yeah. We behave out of our emotions. Motion occurs from the way we feel, and feelings are informed by the way we think. Whatever our paradigm is, it determines the condition of our feelings, which determines the condition of our behavior. Now, fast forward with me to the end of time. Jesus just told us, listen, in the first text, Jesus told us, I do what I see, right? Second text, he says, you do what you see. Third text, John 16, 2 and 3, Jesus now takes us to the end of time. Here is the crux of the matter in end time prophecy. If you've ever wondered what the real issue was, people asked me, just the other night someone asked me. They said, oh, it's going to be a time of trouble such as never was. It's going to be an awful time. There's going to be tribulation. There's going to be pressure. No man can buy or sell at that time. They're going to threaten our lives. There's going to be persecution. How do I know I'll make it? And you know what I said to them? I said, you will be whoever you are. Yeah. You will act out your true identity at that point. Under pressure, all facades are dropped. And if the core of your being is self-centered, you will lash out and hurt other people and join with the persecutors to save your hide. No matter how clearly, doctrinally, factually, you were taught that that time was coming and you shouldn't do that, you will act out the deep inner core of your theology. And if you, in your heart of hearts, do truly know the character of God to be a God of incredible love who never resorts to force, you will look at a worldwide system that is forcing worship, and you will find that it is absolutely incompatible with every fiber of your being. And you will be willing to die rather than to submit to forcing or manipulating anybody's mind in a system of worldwide, one world religion that seeks to force people to worship God on any level. You simply cannot help but be who you are. So, Jesus said it this way. John 16, verse 2 and 3. Notice it carefully. Verse 2. They will put you out of the synagogues, that is, out of the churches. Yes, the time is coming that whoever kills you will think that he offers God's service. Now help me out here. They're being put out of what? Churches. So who's putting people out here? Religious people or non-religious people? Who's doing the... These are religious people, right? This is not all the atheists in the world ganging up against all the Christians. That's the popular view if you read popular novels about end-time events. All the Christians are bunched into one, and all the overtly satanic secularists are over here. According to Bible prophecy, it's going to be religious folks ganging up against other religious folks. It's going to be people believing certain things about God and acting out their belief system about God against other people who have a different picture of God. One group of people have a picture of God that allows for coercion and the violation of other people's conscience. It allows for the violation of human liberty. It allows for persecution. The other picture of God does not allow for persecution, because the other view says that the basic fundamental element of God's character is love and not force. God is interested in willing, voluntary worship, not manipulated, forced worship. See, those are the two groups at the end of time. So check out what Jesus says here. He says, those who kill you will think they're doing God's service. Now notice how he unravels it in verse 3. And these things they will do. Where are we at now? The behavioral level, right? These things they will do to you. Underline the word because. Because here's the pathology. Here is the deep inner psychological reason. Here's the motive. Here's why. Okay? These things they will do to you because they have not known me or my Father. Isn't that incredible? Jesus just clearly explained where the division will occur at the end of time. Some people truly know the Father and Jesus for who they really are, and they will live in love and give freedom and pursue and preserve freedom and defend freedom. But the other people, they have a picture of God that includes, they have a theology that includes everything from God torturing people in purgatory for a time, that's people who are going to end up in heaven, to God torturing people in hell forever. It's not a big stretch to torture a few people along the way yourself if you believe that God is that kind of person. Like the priest said to Tyndale, who was a young man in his life, was translating the Bible into English, and the priest sat at Tyndale's table there and said, young Tyndale, be sure that you realize that there are fires on earth and there are fires in hell. Be sure that the one is not needful to spare thee the other. In other words, if you don't stop translating the Bible into English, we're going to burn you at the stake in order to try to help you redeem your soul through suffering so God doesn't have to burn you for all eternity. So that's why they were burning people right in the middle of the city. This was no secret. They thought they were doing God a favor. They thought they were doing what God wanted them to do. And at the end of time, those who do the persecuting will think they're doing God a favor. This is what Jesus is explaining to you and me. Proverbs 23, verse 7, in a very nice, straightforward way, explains what we're talking about tonight. It says, for as he, that is a human being, as a man thinks in his heart, what's the rest of it? So is he. Underline thinks and underline is. Thinks, is. As a man thinks, so is he. Our thoughts, the content of our heads, comes out in our behavior. Now in Daniel chapter 7, we are brought face to face with this end time system that will bring about a picture of God in organized church-state religion. It says there in Daniel 7, verse 25, he, that is this end-time power, sometimes called the Antichrist, sometimes called the little horn, sometimes called the beast of Revelation 13. You're familiar with all those terms? Okay, this is the little horn, this is the Antichrist, and here's what the Antichrist is all about. It says there, verse 25, he, the Antichrist, shall speak pompous words against who? Against the Most High. So who's being spoken about here? And in what kind of way? Yeah. Pompous words against the Most High. And shall, what's the next word? Persecute the saints of the Most High God, and shall intend to change times and laws, and so on. The point here is that this power will be committing two great crimes against the universe in tandem. Defaming the character of God and following with persecution right on the heels of that defamation of God's character. A parallel passage on page 2 of your outline is Revelation 13:6, speaking of the same power, but describing his actions with different language. It says, and he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God to blaspheme his what? name his tabernacle and those who dwell in heaven. Now, what is the name of God? We learned in a previous meeting that name signifies character, right? So this is not talking about just misspelling Yahweh as a word. This is not talking about saying something negative about the alphabetical collection of letters to form the syllables, not name in the shallow sense, but name in the character sense. When it says there that he will blaspheme God and blaspheme his name, it means that this power, under a guise of representing God, is going to create a false picture of God's character in the minds of those who submit to this belief system. So Daniel 8, chapters 11 through 14, adds more to the picture. In verse 11 it says, of the same power, the Antichrist, at the end of time, he even exalts himself as high as the prince of the hosts. Who is the capital P, the prince of the hosts? Jesus. And this power is exalting himself as high as the prince of the hosts. And by him, that is the Antichrist, the daily sacrifices, or the daily, I don't have time to explain that right now, were taken away, and the place of his, that is Jesus' sanctuary, was cast down. The sanctuary is the system of salvation. Now notice this. Because of transgression, an army was given over to the horn, the little horn, to oppose the daily sacrifice. And he cast what to the ground? The truth to the ground. So this power, an army is given to him. Is that word army bringing to your mind the idea of a religious power or a political power with military might? Yeah, this is a religious power that is harnessing military power to force people's consciences to believe according to its picture of God. Revelation 13 and 14 is fascinating. I want you to be encouraged tonight to read all of chapters 13 and 14 of Revelation. I'm giving you a synopsis here for space sake and for time's sake here. But I want you to realize that in Revelation 13, which is the premier end-time prophecy of what's going to be going down before this world comes to an end, the key word used repeatedly in Revelation 13 is the word image. The image of the beast, to be exact, opposed to and against the true image of God. Now, this image, this religious political system, will be formed on the pretext of a religious belief system, a theology about God, that allows for the joining of church and state, for the restriction of liberty, and for the exercise of force and persecution. Now listen, simultaneously, while this picture of God is being acted out, no man can buy or sell unless you worship God the way we're prescribing. That's what it says in Revelation 13. What does it mean? You can't buy or sell. On an individual level, that's some kind of boycott. On an international level, we call that sanctions, right? When a state power, when a power in the world that is political has enough military backing to say to the market of any nation, you comply or you will suffer economic repercussions. We will not trade with you. We will not send you any product. We will not buy anything you produce. You cannot buy, you cannot sell. Do you get the picture? Is that the kind of pressure that you would imagine, or do you see that kind of pressure being exerted by Jesus to save souls in the New Testament? No. God doesn't operate that way. That's the point. No man can buy or sell, and then what's the next step if you don't comply at that level? You'll be killed. All right? That's Revelation 13, and it's all surrounding around a particular religious system that is forming an image of God that is demanding that be worshipped. Now, opposed to that image is in chapter 14. The first thing you read in 14, now follow this progression. Chapter 13 of Revelation says that this end-time power will form an image of the beast, an image that portrays a picture of God that involves force and coercion, they will form that image. Chapter 13 ends with that warning, and you know how chapter 14 begins? I saw a sea of glass as clear as crystal, and standing on the sea of glass, a group of people who had the Father's name in their forehead. There's the contrast. Chapter 13, there's one image of God, and the people are acting on that image. Chapter 14, there is an entirely different picture of God in the foreheads of God's true and faithful people at the end of time who have believed the true image of God presented to them in the person of Jesus Christ. Where do you want to be in that final unraveling of end time events? Well, you want to be acting on a true and accurate picture of God. That's why, as we read on an earlier evening, Isaiah 40, verses 5 and 9, that the proclamation of the gospel, the evangelizing of the world, is summarized in these three words. Those who bring the good news, the good tidings to the world, what do they say to the world? The last three words of verse 9 of chapter 40. Behold your God. Why is that the gospel? Why is that the proclamation? Do you see why it's the proclamation now in the context of everything we've considered tonight? Do you see why it's so crucial that at this level we are communicating evangelistically, disseminating through the world? Do you see why it's so vital that we deal with people at this level? That we say to them, behold your God, that we feed their thoughts with the truth about God's goodness and love, so they then will emotionally sense and feel deeply the truth about God and then behave in accordance with what we've communicated about God? Do you see why end time events isn't really on the highest level about figuring out timelines and wondering when it's all going to happen? It's not when so much as it is what are the issues. Because when is not really the crucial matter. Whenever it happens, if we have the gospel clearly defined in our minds as the backdrop, we will be on the right side of the issues. There's no question about it. And through that picture of God, through that gospel, when persecution comes, God will make you strong to get through it. You will not deny Him. Why? Because you love Him. And you're not in this fundamentally for yourself. You're in this for His glory and His pleasure. And your whole motive for living is entirely different than a self-centered motive. So whether you can buy or sell, and whether your life is taken, because it's not about me, my life, or my meals. It's about Him, knowing and loving Him. Look at the last text here this evening. 2 Corinthians 3:18. We've read it before. We'll read it again. We should etch this verse in memory's hall. And we've gone by a lot here, and I want to encourage you to read all the text tonight that we didn't get time to look at. Please notice here, we all, with unveiled face, that is, with no veil between, here's the key word, beholding, as in a mirror, the glory of the Lord, are being what? Transformed into the same image from glory to glory, just as by the Spirit of the Lord. Underline the word beholding. That is what occurs at this level. That's where we form thoughts about God. Right? Beholding. Beholding what? The glory of God, which is a biblical word for the character of God. Then what happens as we behold, as we think right thoughts about God, we begin to feel right feelings about God, and we begin to behave in the image of God, because it says there, by beholding, we become transformed. Praise God. We become transformed by that beholding action. Is it one big momentary quantum leap transformation? What does it say? From glory to glory. That's describing progression, right? This is incremental. This is something that is moving, right? I see him more clearly right now than I've ever seen him before, and I find myself merging toward that image, right? I want to be more like what I see in him, and I'm moving in that direction. It's from one stage of glory to the next. Each new perception, each clearer perception of God's character yields greater beauty in our own characters. And this is the basic law that governs every single person sitting here tonight, myself included, and every human being that walks this earth. And so the final word is that the most crucial issue that you and I will ever deal with is our picture of God. So the proclamation of the gospel that we've been aiming for this last 2 weeks is, behold your God.